Thanks for that nice introduction, Jim, and thanks to the organizers for putting together this fabulous meeting already. I've learned a lot through exchange of ideas and information, and it's all just been fabulous. So let me just get my presentation up here. So I should add that those Mexican free-tail bats actually fly in very high altitude, so when they're going that fast, there aren't many trees or mountains to crash into.
Brazilian,
same group, yeah. Okay, let me see if this is... Okay, so the title of my talk is Active Listening, and I just want to start by making the point that behavior of movement contributes to auditory processing in a wide range of animals. Now, where is the pointer on here? Is this? No, that's
fine. There's an old-fashioned bamboo pointer behind you.
Okay. But this is the pointer. Okay. Yeah, I never thought it could get worse than that. But, but here you see examples from humans, penguins, dolphins. These are blind individuals who use echolocation. Elephants, I was mentioning to Jim earlier, there is another Cynthia Moss, known for her research on elephants, but I'm often confused with her, but we will not be getting into her work. Okay. So I work on echolocating bats, and I show several different species of bats in this slide to remind myself to tell you that there are over 1,300 species of bats. That have a variety of diets. This bat here feeds on nectar. This bat is going after a little frog. This bat is taking fish out of water. This bat is going for some fruit. And of course, many bats feed on insects. And so with this diversity of bats come a variety of adaptations. And so I often make the mistake of referring to the bat, but in fact, that's somewhat misleading. What we learn from one bat species may not actually apply to others, and I'll try to differentiate, but sometimes I do slip into that problem of confusing animals. Let's see, so there we go. Okay, so not all bats echolocate. Some rely heavily on vision, but those that do echolocate use very high-frequency sounds that are well-suited to reflect off of objects in the path of the sound beam. And the bat listens to echo returns, processes this information to represent the world in 3D. And so across species, we see that frequencies can range up to 200 kilohertz, and the emission amplitudes can get up to 140 dB SPL at 10 centimeters. So here's an introduction, or an outline of my talk. We'll see how far I get. I'll start with an introduction to bat echolocation, and oops, still learning this. So first I'll just make a brief statement about why bats, and I'll get into a little bit more detail on bat diversity and their habitat, diet, and signal design. I'll talk a little bit about bat hearing and echo processing, and then get into adaptive echolocation call design. It is the bat changes the features of its signals in response to the information it receives from the environment, and that provides us with a window to this feedback system that's central to spatial perception through echolocation. And that will be the focus of sort of the studies I'll tell you about where we're analyzing adaptive echolocation behavior. In prey capture, obstacle avoidance, target discrimination, in a cocktail party. And then I'll talk a little bit about lingual echolocation. So the beginning of the talk, I'll be describing bats that use laryngeal echolocation there. But there are some bats that actually make tongue clicks, and I'll talk a bit about them. These are Egyptian fruit bats. And then blind humans that have developed the ability to echolocate using tongue clicks. And finally, if time permits, I'll get into some neural mechanisms of echolocation. This will be the topic of my research seminar, which will be actually in July. So some of you may have already left, hopefully. So I'll try to give you a flavor for that if there's time. Okay, so why bats? So first of all, echolocation makes use of a standard mammalian auditory system. So bats hear with all the same parts that other animals do. Some regions may be enlarged, and there may be some specializations in circuitry. But comparative studies can help us separate specializations in hearing from general principles. And the active sensing system of the bat provides a direct window to the information they use to guide their behavior. So they're producing sounds in response to information they've processed, so we can get a window into what the bat is thinking. Okay. So as I mentioned, there are over 1,300 species of bats. Approximately 800 of these species echolocate. They have a variety of diets I referred to in the first slide, where some may eat insects, fruits, small vertebrates, nectar, blood. They live in diverse habitats, tropical, temperate, deserts, and they have diverse signal designs, and I'll get into that a little bit, talking about bats that use constant frequency signals and those that use frequency modulated signals, and then the broadband clicks or the tongue clicks I was just.
So the 500 that don't echolocate hunt visually?
Yes. They have very well-developed sensitive vision. So they're nocturnal still, but they see well at night. Yeah.
And so you're stirring together megacloptera and microcloptera, the food bats versus?
Well, so there are microchiroptera. They've actually revised all the terminology. I don't want to get into that now. But there are bats that eat fruit that use echolocation. And then there are some bats, usually the larger bats, tend to not echolocate and rely on vision.
So we're supposed to forget about micro versus mega. That's out.
It's out. Okay. Great. Yeah.
Jenny?
Yeah.
Are there any diurnal bats? Okay. So that's a general principle.
Yeah. I mean, so there are bats that live in regions of the world where it may stay light for a good part of the summer. Okay. So then, you know, and bats. No bats are blind, and so all bats that use echolocation may also use vision for some of their behaviors. Okay, so this is just to give you a feel for bat diversity, and especially pay attention to their ears. So this is a free-tailed bat. This is a false vampire bat. So this is a bat that actually eats a variety of foods, not blood. This bat and many bat species actually emit signals through the nostrils, but the research I will tell you about in more detail involves an echolocating bat that produces sounds through the open mouth. Let's see, here we have some of these other bats that make sounds through the nostrils. This is the nectar-feeding bat. This is the fishing bat. This is the frog-eating bat. As I mentioned, many bats eat bugs. Sometimes the bugs can be close to the size of the bats. And then they're foraging in different habitats. So some bats may be foraging very close to vegetation, sometimes in edges and gaps, sometimes out in the open, and then over water. And so with this diversity of the environments in which they echolocate and seek food, avoid obstacles, they've evolved different signal designs. And here are just some examples of echolocation signals from some different species. So this is the greater horseshoe bat, Rhinolophus firmaquinum. It produces a long constant frequency signal at about 83 kilohertz, followed by a frequency modulated sweep. So this is an insectivorous bat. These are also insectivorous bats. This one uses multiple harmonics, very short signals with energy concentrated around 32 kilohertz. This bat produces a sweep with energy at about 40 kilohertz. And this is the echolocation signal of the fishing bat. It's a hook upward and then downward sweep. And this is just to give you a flavor for the diversity and why one can't necessarily generalize data from one species to other species.
So the fishing bat aren't using it for hunting, right? Just underwater? Right?
Well, you know what? They are actually detecting ripples in the water produced by fish swimming close to the surface.
Magic.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a plot to just show you the hearing range of different echolocating animals along with humans. So here we have the human audiogram, and this is an audiogram of an oil bird and a swiftlet. These birds actually are known to use some echolocation. This is the audiogram of the tongue-clicking Egyptian fruit bat. I'll tell you a little bit about that towards the end of the talk. And the big brown bat of Tessicus fuscus, which has been the workhorse in my lab. Now, just a little bit of a close-up now and a couple of audiograms. I want to make the point that that's really here over a very wide range. And this, again, is the audiogram of the big brown bat, and this is the audiogram of the greater horseshoe bat. So both of these species have hearing at lower frequencies that's probably used for social communication, and then at higher frequencies for echolocation. Note that the greater horseshoe bat shows a specialization with increased sensitivity in this narrow frequency band. Here it shows it around 81.5 kilohertz. And actually, at slightly lower frequencies, just off from that, their hearing threshold is much higher. Okay, so just a quick review on the cues that bats use to localize objects in space. As I mentioned, of course, bats are mammals, and they use the same basic principles that other mammals do to localize objects. But here now they're producing a sound and listening to an echo return. So if the object is right along the bat's midline, the sounds will, the echo will return to the two ears at equal amplitude, same time, same spectral features, and the bat can localize that the object is right along the midline. Yeah.
Are bats' ears fixed? Right?
No, bats' ears are mobile, and the movements also are species specific.
I guess if the target is moving, are the bats moving relative to the target? Some doppler shift.
Especially for the greater horseshoe bat, the bats that use the CF signals, that seems to be an important feature. For the bats that use short FM signals, probably it's less important.
And if you plug one ear, are they hopeless, or do they swivel the other ear to compensate?
They can compensate. They don't like it when their ears are plugged.
One ear is plugged.
Yeah, one ear is plugged even. I think a bat with some hearing loss in one ear probably could learn to compensate over time. But for the most part, bats rely heavily on this binaural hearing that's intact.
And after you unplug the ear, after they've compensated, they would be confused for a while? What's the healing time?
No one's really done that study. I mean, one of my students actually did want to do some ear plugging experiments and was not successful because the bats just didn't like the plugs. Okay. And here, just it's an example of a target that's off axis, so this ear will receive an echo a little bit earlier in time, and at greater amplitude, the bat can compute the interaural difference, and horizontal localization accuracy in the big brown bat has been estimated to be about 1 degree. And bats use spectral cues for vertical localization, just like we do, and here you see this. It's the external ear of the big brown bat and the tragus, a flap that creates some spectral interference so that sounds arriving from different elevations will result in different spectral profiles at the eardrum. So this is just a plot. It comes from work of Jim Simmons of the spectrum of a sound arriving at the bat's eardrum from 15 degrees above the horizon to 10 degrees below. And note that there's a notch in the spectrum that shifts to lower frequencies with the elevation. And vertical discrimination has been estimated to be about 3 degrees in the big brown bat. Okay, now target ranging is where bats really sort of separate themselves from many other mammals. They produce a call, results in an echo, and they can measure the time delay between the outgoing call and the returning echo. And for sound that's traveling at about 340 meters per second, there's roughly 6 milliseconds of echo delay. That's its travel out and back for each meter of target distance. So it was first demonstrated by Jim Simmons that bats do use echo delay to measure distance. And he designed some very clever experiments where he had bats trained to rest on a platform and produce echolocation signals, which were picked up by microphones, one to the left, one to the right. The signals were digitized, delayed, and played back to the bat through loudspeakers to simulate echoes from objects at different distances. The bat was trained to always approach the side on which the closer object or the shorter echo delay was returned, and this was randomly switched from trial to trial, the bat would crawl, in this case to the left, and receive a food reward. Next trial, this one might be on the right, and the bat would be rewarded for crawling again towards the right. And what's plotted here is percent correct responses as a function of the difference in distance between the two targets and the corresponding time delay in microseconds. So when the target distance or delay was large, the bat performed at about 100%, and then as the difference in distance between the two began to decrease, the bat's performance slowly dropped, and Jim defined threshold here as the difference in distance that resulted in 75% correct performance, which is about 1 centimeter or 60 microseconds in delay. So there are other studies using different psychophysical tests requiring the bat to detect a change in echo delay, and some of those studies reveal that the bat can do much, much better discriminating time delays in the sub-microsecond range. But I'm not going to get into those. That would probably take the whole talk. And Jim Simmons will be here later in July, and I'm sure that will be a topic that will also interest him to get into. But this is the basics.
And these bats have their wings clipped?
So? No, they're trained to rest on the platform.
Okay.
And this is where they get their food. So they...
They're flying to the food, though?
In these experiments, the bat is actually crawling on this platform. It learns to do that. I mean, it might fly away every once in a while. Jim's early experiments did actually involve bats flying to an object, but this ended up working better. Okay, so the spatial localization, what we see in bats and their target tracking, requires a very tight coordination between auditory processing and adaptive sonar behaviors. And I thought I'd illustrate this in a short video clip that I made many years ago, where it's a high-speed video clip of a bat flying towards a tethered insect and taking the insect. And, whoops, what happened there? I'll come back to it. I think it just went to the video. And the audio is also recorded at high speed, and both the video and audio have been slowed down by a factor of 16, so you can see the bat flying and hear the bat's, we're going backwards, let's see. So you can, you'll see the bat flying and hear the echolocation calls because they've been slowed down, and spectrograms of the calls that the bat's producing. So what I want to draw to your attention are the changes in the timing and, the rate at which the bat's producing calls, as well as, so here are the calls, bat will appear in a minute, and the interval between the calls, and also the duration of the calls, and the time frequency characteristics. Oops, sorry.
How much did this bat, or slow down? Right?
Sorry?
How much did this slow down? This is
16, okay. By a factor of 16. Okay.
This is a Jessica?
This is the big brown bat. So this is a bat that's producing sounds through the open mouth. Tethered insect right there. This bat is not flying 160 kilometers an hour. It's flying at about 4 meters per second.
So did he do a tail capture?
Yes. And this is the standard for this bat species. It tends to take the prey in the tail membrane. Sometimes bats will scoop them up into the wing. Okay. But it's almost unheard of that a bat will take an insect directly into the mouth.
So it was vocalizing again in much less than a second.
Yes, the bat can talk and eat at the same time.
And the vocalization changed as it closed in on the insect.
Exactly, and that's what I'm going to be getting into that in more detail, but yes, the bat is constantly monitoring echo information and using that to adjust the features of its calls. Okay.
So when the pulses sped up, I guess that was when it was closing in?
Exactly.
It's kind of what a missile does when it was.
There are some interesting parallels there, yeah. Okay.
Has it ever been observed when a bat can piggyback on someone else's echolocation call during a hunting battle?
I'm going to get into that a little bit. The short answer is not definitively, but this is an interesting open question. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about adaptive echolocation behavior in the bat, the greater horseshoe bat, that uses this constant frequency signal. And this is from a very old paper, a review paper by Neuweiler, Bruns, and Schuler. And this bat exhibits a behavior referred to as Doppler shift compensation. So remember, this bat has very high hearing sensitivity at around 83 kilohertz. And so what you see here is a plot of sound frequency over time. The bat is flying from one end of the room to another. So it's here, it's stationary, takes off, and this is during the flight period. This is the frequency of the vocalizations. And this is the frequency of the returning echo. So as the bat takes off and begins to increase its velocity, it lowers the frequency of its calls such that the echoes return at sound frequency to which it is maximally sensitive. Okay. So this was demonstrated back in the 70s by Uli Schnitzler, who was my postdoc advisor in Tübingen. Okay, so there are specializations in the cochlea of the greater horseshoe bat. This comes from the same review, where you see here, this is the thickness of the basilar membrane, and in this region that's responsive to 83 to 86 kilohertz, there's this specialization, and as we talked about last week, I think it was, the Q values of neurons in this bat species auditory system are extraordinarily high, some of them getting up to 200, 500. This is the same kind of data, the Q values for a bat species, the little ground bat, that uses frequency modulated signals. So these are much lower. These are the echolocation signals. So you see the high Q values occur at the sound frequencies that are important to the bat for echolocation.
So I can see that, like, if you devote so much space of the basal membrane to, say, that short or small frequency difference between, say, 83 to 86 kilohertz, that you get these high Q values. But it's not clear to me why the thickness suddenly increases. Is that understood? Like, what is that doing? Why is the thickness jumping as you go into that region?
This is not my work, but as I understand it, it's some specialization that enables this expansion of the representation at around 83 kilohertz. To the best of my knowledge, this hasn't been followed up in greater detail with more modern techniques. So this comes from a review in the 1980. I think the work was done sometime in the 70s.
So is that surprising to cochlear modeling people?
Yeah, it's not.
Was it George Pollock's first paper?
No, this is from this German group. George Pollock worked largely on the Mexican free-tail bat. He collaborated a little bit with these folks, but it's anatomist Bruns. Yeah. Okay, but what are the consequences of this Doppler shift compensation? So one is that the bat can separate the frequency channels for vocal production and echo processing. So these calls tend to be rather long in duration, and so the bat doesn't have to worry about the calls and echoes overlapping because they are in separate frequency channels. So here you see this is call and this is echo, so that they have a separation that enables the processing of the echoes. And also, by ensuring that the echoes return to the bat at the frequency to which the bat is most sensitive, it can detect small Doppler shifts and amplitude modulations in the returning echo that result from fluttering insect prey. So that's just shown here. And years ago, Funda, Emde, and Menet published a paper where they looked at the greater horseshoe bat's ability to discriminate insects fluttering at different rates. Okay, so this is basic setup where they had a phantom target echo of a fluttering insect on opposite sides, following the same basic paradigm that Jim Simmons did, where the bat was trained to approach one side of the platform where the positive stimulus was presented. In this case, this was an insect beating its wings at 50 hertz. And on the other side, the echo that returned was from an insect beating its wings at some lower rate. And here,
distinguish between insects or the speed at which an insect is flying?
This particular study was looking at the bat's ability to discriminate different wing beat rates of the same insect. But there was a follow-up study that showed that the same species could actually discriminate and later recognize echoes from novel orientations through this same basic procedure. Yeah.
Basic question. Does a bat's echolocating ability improve when it's moving, since you have a bigger separation between the vocalization and the echo frequency?
No one has done those experiments with this species. In my lab, we have moved to doing a lot of experiments where the bat is flying, and we haven't done a direct comparison between stationary and flying bats, but what they can do in flight is quite extraordinary.
And behaviorally, are bats doing a lot of echolocation when they're just stationary?
Some species will rest on a perch and scan, so it's not completely unnatural, but there definitely is more information that the bat gets from its own motion in natural behaviors.
These experiments are all done in the dark, so we don't have to worry about visual cues?
Well, yes, and not only that, but there are no visual cues. They're done under low-level lighting, but in this case, there's a phantom target echo. There's a microphone that's picking up the bat signal. The signal is modulated and played back, so there is no visual cue. And this is a plot of the percent correct performance as a function of the difference between the S minus, the slower flutter rate, and the S plus, the 50 hertz flutter rate. And so these bats, these are data from three different individual bats, can discriminate between an insect that's fluttering at 50 hertz from one that's fluttering at about 46, 47 hertz. So they're very good. Okay. Now, as I mentioned, the workhorse in my lab has been the big brown bat that emits sounds through the open mouth. It produces a very broadband signal that is well suited for localization. There's a fundamental that sweeps from over 60 kilohertz down to 20 some kilohertz, typically in just a couple of milliseconds. But they do modulate the duration and the bandwidth of these signals. And the sonar localization accuracy, just to review, the species is 1 degree in the horizontal plane, 3 degrees vertical, and distance about 1 centimeter or 60 microseconds. So now I'm going to describe some studies that we did in my lab to look at head and ear movements, bats that were tracking a target. And in order to really be able to get a good look at the head and the pinna, the ear movements, we needed to have the bat stationary. So the bat is trained to rest on this platform. We've done neural recordings, but I'm not going to talk about those today. The bat is tracking a target, a tethered mealworm, that's delivered to the bat through a pulley system. I'll show you a video so you can see this. And we can record the bat's echolocation signals, the echoes that return, and then we have high-speed motion capture cameras to really look at the head and the pinna position. And here is you'll see the video. it outlines this search phase where the bat is looking for a target, approach phase where it begins to speed up the signals as it's getting closer, and the terminal buzz phase where the bat is preparing to capture. And that's what we've seen in flight. That was what was illustrated in that video. But what we can also capture in this paradigm is we can evoke the same changes in echolocation behavior in a stationary bat where the target is moving that we would see normally when the bat is flying to the target. Okay, so now this is a wide view. This is the bat, and you're listening to the output of a bat detector. Picks up the high frequency sounds, allows us to hear them. Okay. And this is now high speed video audio slowed down, so you see spectrograms of the calls. Note that the call rate is speeding up as the target gets closer. You'll see that the target will appear. Okay, bat gets its food reward. So this is the only time it gets its food, so it really is content to stay on the platform. Okay. So in this particular study, there were different target trajectories introduced to the bat. So what you see here is distance between the bat and the target. It's a function of time. So there were the trial you just saw was what we refer to as one target simple. The target moves just directly to the bat. We sometimes had two targets hanging together. Oh, that was actually two targets. But also just going directly to the bat. Then we had, in some cases, two targets where one would actually pass the other and arrive a little bit earlier than the other. And this is what we call one target complex, where the target approached the bat, teased it, moved it away, and then approached again, moved away, and then returned. Okay. And all of these show that the bat is increasing its rate of vocalizations as the target gets closer. Okay, so now here's another video that illustrates just how we reconstructed the pinna position. We really, the pinna movements are very complex, so this is highly simplified. There are markers placed on the two ears and then one on the head, and we were just looking at the separation between the ears for this particular study. So the red and blue are the two pinna, and then we've got the echolocation calls. So with this quick video, it's not clear what's going on, but with careful measurement of the separation between the pinna, we found something kind of interesting, and that is as the target approaches the bat, the ears move apart. And so what you see here is the separation between the two pinna as a function of distance. So this is when the target is just very close to the bat. And this occurs across, this is lots and lots of trials. Now when we introduce that one target complex, remember the target's moving back and forth, you see that the pinna move apart, and then they move closer together, and they move apart again, closer together, and so on. And these asterisks indicate the points in time when the target is reversing direction.
Are these small numbers of millimeters relative to some initial rest position or something?
This is, yes, a change in the...
Does this distance and pinna distance correlate with a broadening of the beam when the insect gets closer?
The beam does broaden as the frequency drops. So to some extent, that would apply here at the very end when the bat is engaged in this terminal buzz. But we also see it before it enters into that buzz phase.
If you make the target wobble as it approaches the bat, do the pinna rotate in response?
We haven't looked in detail at the complex pinna movements yet, but that's definitely something that we want to look at. here are just data from the other conditions comparing one target simple and two target simple, one target simple, two target pass, and two target pass, and two target simple. And basically, the inner pinna separation is reduced in the two target tracking conditions. And of course, what is, you know, we're very interested in what's going on, the acoustics, and that's one of our next steps. But drawing from work by Rolf Mueller and his colleagues, can see that the pinna in an upright position will collect sound returning predominantly along the midline, and the pinna in the, as the pinna moves apart, it's actually more flattened position, which will also pick up more sensitivity at peripheral locations.
Does that make any sense in this paradigm?
Well, what we think is happening is that as the bat is moving the ears apart, it's increasing the interaural cues that may help it with the localization.
Well, what would be the cost of keeping them apart? Do you think it's an aerodynamic drag? So he doesn't want to do it until the moment of truth?
Well, we don't actually know what's going on as the bat is flying. So here there's no aerodynamic drag because the animal's...
Right, but I'm just trying to see behaviorally.
Yeah,
why bother? Because if broader is better, you might as well just leave them separate.
Yeah, yeah. We would really be very interested to look at this in the flying bat. So we don't have the resolution in the video to be able to look at pinna position, but that would certainly, we want to compare what we found on the platform with the free-flying bat.
It looks like when they're closer together, there's more of a forward sensitivity, which might be important.
For detection.
When the prey is distant.
Yeah.
And as it comes close, there's a bigger angular uncertainty. It needs to switch from distance mode to angle mode, more or less.
Yeah, or detection mode to, yeah. And we also did look at head movements. And I can show you quickly another video that illustrates that the bat waggles its head as this is all happening. Happened there.
In the dark.
Yeah. Oh my, it looks like my PowerPoint is not happy. There's a little, I may have to actually close and start again.
Maybe it's best to exit the presentation, but still keep it large and then play the video.
I think I have to quit PowerPoint. It's not letting me do anything.
So to be as while she's doing that, this thickening of the basal membrane is the thing called the secondary osseous spiral lateral. So the lateral portion gets this heavy layer of extra tissue under it. And at least the original idea is that this just makes a better resonator. So since the whole piece is resonating almost at the same frequency now, you're not worried as much about frequency dispersion along that length. I'm not sure if that's right or not. But you're adding a mass and presumably making the thing taller and trying to achieve very high and uniform oscillatory frequency. At least that's the idea. It's very
But it's funny that when it jumps at the quote discontinuity, you would then expect that you suddenly go from whatever it is, 80 kilohertz down to maybe 40 kilohertz resonance. It might go down, I think, like in these. And mass, it looked like it went down from 83 kilohertz to maybe 63 kilohertz or something. But
what is the tissue that's thickening? Is it the basement membrane?
It's hanging sort of, at least the pictures I've seen, from the lower surface of the basal membrane.
Okay.
So it's some sort of connective tissue, but what it is exactly, I don't know.
So cantilever fibers or something?
No, I don't think it's anything like that.
And so you would also think it rather increases the mass and doesn't increase stiffness. I thought initially there are many more fibers that form a very dense fiber core that would make it very stiff.
It
might be both.
It hangs down just a glob. I mean, it isn't taut all the way, extending all the way to the edges. So it looks like somebody just loaded a mass onto it.
Okay, hopefully we're back in business. So this is now a video of the head waggle. You basically get the idea. So the head waggles may also enhance acoustic localization cues through increasing inaural level differences in level, arrival time, and spectrum. Okay.
So this is helps give you better azimuthal measurement. Sorry, vertical measurement, elevation.
But they're also, you know, the bat's doing all kinds of things here. So this is a stationary bat tracking a target. We see that the bat does adapt its echolocation signals in much the same way it does when it flies towards a target, but we really need to look at this in the flying bat to understand.
And the illumination here is
It's low level. So here, of course, there are visual cues, but the lighting is very low level, long wavelength light, just so that we can capture data with the video.
And the bat can see a little bit.
We don't think so, actually, because there have been ERG reportings from this bat species that suggest it shouldn't see. But we can't exclude it, absolutely. But it's actually, it's adapting its echolocation behavior in response to the target position, which is really what we're mostly interested in.
And the target is going by sideways?
No, it's coming straight toward it. We've done some preliminary experiments changing the direction. One thing that we're working on is a project where the target will actually go behind an occluder and arrive at the bat, but those are still in progress. Okay, so now what I've described so far is a really pretty simplified situation, bat detecting target out in the open environment, responding to changes in distance, but oftentimes, bats are operating in much more complex environments. Oh, this is now, this is not the right, something happened here. Wrong version of the, maybe I better go out of this, actually, because we need some changes to the talk that may. My file when it crashed, and now it won't go back to the. Okay, there we go. Okay, sorry about that. Showing up here.
It's not plugged in.
Oh, it's not plugged in. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So now, when a bat is operating in an environment where there are lots of objects, it has to perform a more difficult task, and that is separating the echoes that arrive from different objects. And that's illustrated in this cartoon here, where a single vocalization could result in a stream of echoes from different objects, and the task is to segregate these echo streams so that it can then actually assign echoes to different objects. And this, of course, requires accurate localization and azimuth elevation and distance, and we hypothesize that the bat's active control over the features of its signals is central to this process. Okay, so now I'm going to get into a set of studies in which we did detailed behavioral analysis of the bat's echolocation behavior in different tasks, one involving target localization, obstacle avoidance, target discrimination, and as I mentioned, the bat cocktail party. So in my lab, we have this facility, a large room about the size of this room, where we have high-speed cameras. These are Vicon cameras that track the position of markers that are placed on the bat, and then high-speed full video cameras. And we have microphones along the walls and on the floor, so we can reconstruct the bat's flight behavior and coordinated adaptive changes in echolocation calls. And what we have done over the years and helps us understand the bat's echolocation behaviors, we animate the trials that we collect from different experiments. And here's one example of a bat going after a free-flying insect. So this is a bat, and this is a praying mantis that will be released. And plotted below is the interval between successive sounds, the reciprocal, this is the repetition rate, and the duration of the calls. And note the adaptive changes in the animal's echolocation behavior as it tracks this insect. So the audio has been slowed down. These are the actual echolocation signals produced by the bat. This poor insect normally can hear and evade bats, but its ear was covered by the experimenter. Oh.
Okay. Now, was that praying mantis moving vertically?
It was just flying along. If it had heard the bat, it would have taken a dive to the ground and probably escaped the bat.
Shocked. Mantis rights people everywhere.
So here
how big is that room? Like, what is
so it's about the size of this room.
Oh, well, it's huge now.
Yeah. And what you see plotted here, the interval between sounds drops from about 100 milliseconds down to 20, 30. Down, this is the terminal buzz, and then the reciprocal of that, the rate goes up to about 150 sounds per second. And note that the duration of the calls is also dropping. So while there's a general trend for the interval between the calls to shorten as the bat gets closer, I want to draw your attention to the fact that there are these clusters of sounds that sort of alternate between short and longer intervals. We refer to these as sonar sound groups, and this has been the subject of investigation in my lab in a variety of tasks, and I will get back to that if time permits. Okay.
So, can I ask how many clicks or whatever, how many fundamental chirps or what correspond to such a sonar group? How many repetitions?
It depends. So sometimes we'll record three or four of these sounds in a group with each separated by, say, 20 milliseconds. Sometimes we just get two sounds, and the interval between the sounds depends on the absolute distance to the target.
So you said that the bugs escape strategy would be to go to the floor, and that's just because then the depth differences are so small that the bat can't use sonar to find the bugs.
Yeah, well, then it would just be, so in the lab, that's a very secure escape mechanism. In the wild, of course, the elevations that the animals are flying in is much greater. And so what might happen is that the praying mantis would drop, but the bat could still come around and get it as it's approaching the ground, but there wouldn't be that. Once the bug is on the ground, the bat can't get it.
So the safe territory is like on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And your infrared cameras are able to swivel and track, as you mentioned, the feedback?
No, we have lots of cameras.
Okay,
so
right.
Yeah, so.
They're not, and so
their position, this is just a cartoon, but we position them to get maximum 3D reconstruction of the bat's flight path.
Okay.
Can you put a reflector on the insect and the bat both?
So those experiments were done before we had these cameras that did the, so we did these recordings with raw video and just tracked the images on the raw video. Okay, so mentioned we have microphones along the walls. This shows a schematic cartoon. It's from older work where we only had three walls of microphones, but here these are microphones that are used to reconstruct the directional aim of the bat's sonar beam. So here you see the bat pointing its head in this direction, so these microphones will receive stronger signals than these microphones. And looking at the relative distribution of energy across the microphones, we can reconstruct the beam pattern and the beam axis. Now, these microphones are just looking at energy at around 35 kilohertz, the region of high amplitude in this bat signal, but we're now doing much more detailed beam pattern measurements across the spectrum. So what I'll show you is just the energy at around 35 kilohertz.
So I want a question in the room. Are the walls anechoic? So do they give an echo, or are you?
So the walls are lined with acoustic foam, but it certainly echoes return. The foam dampens the echoes and allows us actually to better analyze the data, but it doesn't mean that the bat thinks it's in this.
The bat still gets enough information that it knows where the walls are.
Yeah. So we can also look at the tracking angle, that is the angular separation between a target and the beam axis. And here is just one animation to illustrate. Again, we have the microphones only on these three walls. This is the target, which is a tethered mealworm that's moving in a circular path. Left. Okay, so the point I wanted to make is that really locks the beam on the target. When you saw that beam pattern split briefly, that was just an artifact of the fact that we were missing some microphones on that one wall. But what you see now plotted here is tracking angle, that is the angular separation between the target and the beam axis as a function of distance to the target. So here bats are tracking insects in the lab. And so when the bat is far away from the insect, it may be scanning and pointing its beam all over the place. But once it locks on at a distance of about half a meter, the tracking angle is very small. So it seems very important to the bat for its successful interception of the target to really keep that beam centered on the target.
And the rapid component of that is presumably head motion rather than body motion, is that correct?
Yes, so just to emphasize, this bat is producing sounds through the open mouth, and so the beam aim is aligned with the head.
Yeah. But the point is, when we see the rapid change, it's not that the bat has been able to turn that quickly,
no.
But it's moved
the,
its head.
The head leads the body, and what we're really looking at is the head aim. That sort of the body is, you know. So it is still flying in around to maneuver to catch the bug, but the head is the measure we're looking at here. Okay, so now just to remind you, looking at foraging in a cluttered environment, the bat makes a single sound, and it receives echoes from multiple objects. And so its task is to sort the echoes from different objects. And we've done a study now to test the hypothesis that the perception of the 3D scene depends on this active control over sonar signal direction, duration, frequency, and timing.
There's no evidence that uses phase information or interference?
Oh, there is. That's another. Yeah.
I'm just wondering about it because the wavelength's 10 millimeters and the penna are the same scale, right? Comparable to that.
Yeah.
So you think also its own wings are going to be reflectors that are going to cause interference?
Yeah, it's complicated. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you about a simplified experiment in which the bat had to negotiate an obstacle and go after prey as sort of a first step towards analyzing the bat's behavior in this more complex scenario. So here we have a net stretched across the room. It's a mist net that it has very, it's very fine, but it does return echoes the bat can detect. There are two openings in the net on one side from the other. There's a partition net that divides the back end of the room, and a prey item is available to the bat behind only one of the two openings. So the bat's task is to find the prey item in one compartment and fly through the opening and take the prey. And here's just a quick animation of a trial in which a bat is flying through one opening to get the tether to mealworm. Circles indicate the bat's position and time of vocalizations. There are lots of intervals between the calls and the sound duration. So note how the bat dynamically adjusts the timing of its calls as it approaches the net, the opening.
So see, the net is transparent.
Yeah, it can see through it.
It knows not to run into it.
Yes. And it has experience with this. It has learned. And in learning the task, it could initially fly more alongside the net and receive stronger echoes and find the opening. So this is just the final second of the trial as the bat's going for the prey. So
Well, that's actually open.
They might.
Because
they
can be able to
recover. They recover.
With this example,
it might get tangled in the net. So people catch bats in the wild by setting up these nets. And if they're on autopilot, you know, just sort of flying in a commuting mode, they may not be paying attention to echoes. And yes, they can crash into them.
I was curious, like you joked earlier about flying mealworms, but actually all the experiments were realistic. But this particular one, as far as I can tell, it's just a mealworm hanging there. So the bat can see that.
Yes, you can see that, and it it's hungry, and yes, I mean there are certainly very artificial features of this experiment, but it does tap into some of the natural behaviors we see in the bat. And I was going to show you, but I won't bother playing the animation again, that as the bat approached the net, it was decreasing the interval of its calls. And then as it began to fly through the net, it increased the interval again and then decreased as it began to move in to capture the prey. There were similar changes in the duration of its calls.
It must have changed the angle of attack. What was that about? It swooped down and then up.
Want to see it again?
It goes through the holes if it's going over a hurdle.
I mean, some of it has to do with the way we project this.
Does he have to fold his wings to get through the hole?
It doesn't have to, but it does tend to make a small adjustment in the...
Maybe it loses a little elevation.
Yeah,
loses some lift.
Yeah. Yeah. And this sort of approach to the prey where it doesn't go straight, but goes a bit in a curve, that's very typical.
And if you put the hanging mealworm in a pendulum mode, does it compensate? It's swinging back and forth while it comes in?
So we haven't done exactly that experiment. We've used moving targets, and we see that the bat predicts its point of interception with a target so that it prepares for some future interception. And here are the changes in the interval as the bat gets closer to the net, and then increases the interval and then decreases again. Okay. Now, talk about the sonar beam pattern. So this is now the same trial where we've got the microphones positioned on the walls. This is now an overhead view where you see the openings in the net, and we'll look at the bat's control over its beam pattern as it performs in this task. The stick is the beam axis. Right, the the left. So it sequentially scans the edges of the net opening and then locks on to the target. So these are just some frames from three separate trials. And the point I just want to make is that the bat sequentially points its beam at different objects in the environment. The beam pattern is wide enough that it could just send out sound broadly in some direction and get echoes back. But it actively, carefully controls the position of its beam just the way we do with our eyes as we scan the environment. And so that's just summarized here. What time am I wrapping up here?
When did we start? So I started at 2, but then I think maybe 2:30, so that would go on to 4 or so,
Four.
Okay. So think about some time after.
Okay. So now, just to remind you that the bat is also changing the duration of its calls as it's getting closer to a target. So here's just a sequence of sounds produced by a bat going after an insect. And further back in time, the duration of the call is longer than when it's closer to the target. And why does the bat do this? Remember, in talking about the bat that uses the constant frequency signal, it can separate the outgoing call and the returning echo in different frequency channels, but this bat can't do that. And instead, it adjusts the duration of its calls to avoid overlap. So here's an example, a cartoon to show a call of a particular duration. If there is an object returning an echo that's very close for this particular duration, the echo will overlap the pulse. Bat doesn't like that. It probably reduces its localization accuracy, and therefore it shortens the pulse to separate the pulse and the echo. So now I'm going to show you another video and bring to your attention the fact that the radius of this beam pattern is actually scaled to the duration of the call. So note how the bat adjusts the duration of its call as it approaches the target. So now you see that the target this time is on the other side, the other opening. So here's the beam axis. Looking at the left edge of the net, looking at the net. Now already it's shifted to lock onto the target, the prey item that's behind. And it got it. Okay. So here you see the bat is adjusting the duration of its call to avoid overlap with the net. But then at this point over here, it's preparing to fly through the net. It's locked onto the target and is actually producing calls whose echoes will overlap from the net, not from the target, but from the net. Okay. And so here is summary data from a number of different trials in which we have the time in which the bat fixates the worm, it locks the beam pattern onto the worm relative to net crossing, and the time at which the bat first experiences overlap between its echolocation call and the net echo relative to net crossing. So what we see is as the bat prepares to intercept the target, it shifts its gaze along the distance axis from the obstacle, the net, to the target. Is that clear? So we use this measure of the duration of the call to make some inferences about where along in distance the bat is actually attending. So it's already mapped out its route through the opening in the net. Now it's locked onto the target.
So it's paying attention through the net to the target before it makes it fully through the net.
Yeah.
You can tell that by just the duration of the
exactly.
call.
Yeah. So here we see in this experiment that the bat is making adjustments to its echolocation signals to separate obstacle and prey. So the aim of the beam axis enables segregation of objects in different directions, and the duration enables segregation of objects at different distances. Okay. So now I've also done an experiment using a target discrimination task. I don't think I'm going to go into a lot of detail on this just so I have time to get through other stuff, but I'll just briefly tell you that we had bats discriminating between a smooth bead and textured beads that differed. The smooth bead was S plus. The bat flew and tapped this. It received a food reward. And if it S minus was one of these alternate. And these were placed anywhere in the room. The bat was flying around, and it could perform this discrimination task with training. It was complex trainings. I won't get into this. This is just a video to illustrate the one trial. Maybe I will quickly just show that this is a video that shows the bat's active inspection of the targets. So this is now the S plus, the smooth bead. This is the textured bead. They're just like half a centimeter. So bats could perform this task. Their performance depended on the pairs of beads. We looked at their echolocation behavior, and we found very much the same thing we found in that obstacle avoidance target capture task. So you could use the duration of the calls to make inferences about where which bead the bat was inspecting at any instant in time. We also saw these sound groups, which I may get to talk about later. Will depend on how fast I can get through this. But that's the basic message here. Now I'm going to shift.
So the fact that what we saw in that video and also in the previous ones with the net, that these bats always seem to go on these curved trajectories, that seems to be some information theoretic principle, I guess, right? Or somehow it's not understood, like what's
you know, I think in the wild, so that, you know, I think, you know, bats have evolved certain behavioral strategies that work well in the field, and I think that trajectory can help the bat in pursuing a flying insect, so it can sort of come up from behind and has more time to localize and then prepare to intercept.
So you would think it's not optimized for that, for these particular lab experiments, but it's something optimized for tracking a flying object that might also want to escape or...
Yes, yes, I think. Okay, now on to the bat cocktail party, and just to illustrate for you briefly a bat cocktail party. This is a video, a thermal imaging video taken by Jim Simmons in Belize, and these are bats, looks like daylight, but it's actually around midnight, and you see that they are foraging. You're listening to the output of a bat detector that's recording their signals. There are also, every once in a while, some high-frequency insect sounds. But in this scenario, the bats are avoiding collisions with other bats, and they're pursuing moving and possibly evasive prey. So now, taking this to the laboratory, with a much more simplified situation. We're looking at how the bat's adaptive vocal behavior enables spatial orientation in the presence of conspecifics. Okay. And I'll show you data that illustrate that the bats make adjustments in their call frequencies and also sometimes stop vocalizing altogether, which that piece was a bit of a surprise. So here is the basic setup. We have this large room, high-speed video cameras that allow us to reconstruct the bat's 3D flight path. We have a single tethered insect, so the bats are competing for that prey item. And we've got microphones on the walls, not shown here, and also on the floor. And this is just a short clip taken from two bats that were in the room together. And just looking at this, it's rather difficult to figure out which bat is vocalizing. So one bat, two bats, and so on. My graduate student, Chen Xu, used a combination of video position data and audio arrival time at the microphones to figure out which bat was calling when. And I won't get into the details of the analysis, but it worked. And she was able to determine which bat was calling at any point in time. And what she found is that there were several strategies bats used to minimize interference from conspecifics. There may be also other things going on that I can get into in discussion, but they showed an increase in call design separation, beam directing behavior, and also, as I mentioned, this silent behavior. So here's the spectrogram of the big brown bat's echolocation signal I showed before. So she measured the duration of the calls, the interval of the calls, between calls, the start frequency of the fundamental, the end frequency of the fundamental, and then the total bandwidth. And now here's just a selected trial of two bats. So one bat is shown in red, one bat is shown in blue, and plotted below here are the pulse intervals between the calls, the duration of the calls, and the frequency, the start and the end frequency of the fundamental, all separated by bat according to color. Okay. And what she found is that there were adjustments in call parameters and also silent behaviors. So I'll show you a quick movie of this.
And these were bats that sort of knew each other already?
Yes, and they've had experience in the room. I mean, there are some things that or maybe not so natural, but yeah, the bats did have experience with the task and with each other. And there was some social hierarchy that clearly affected the behavior. That's sort of another.
Same gender bat?
Well, before I play, funny you should ask. So this is, most of the bats in this particular study were male. There was only one female-female pair. We have since followed up on this study and found a huge, what we think is a gender difference, and that the females show different flight configurations and they show different behavioral adaptations. We've done yet another study to try to, with more mixed gender design, to really understand what's going on, and those data are not yet analyzed, but they will be by the end of the summer. Okay, remember when the bat makes a call, a circle is displayed. So you see no circles here. Blue bat needed to make sure it was the food was really gone. Okay. So what Chen found is that bat pairs with similar call design, that is, she flew the bats, ran tests with them individually in an open room. And if they had similar call design when they were paired, they increased the separation between their acoustic parameters, calls. But if they already showed differences in their call structure, they just maintained them. And so this held for the frequency parameters, start frequency, end frequency, and bandwidth. And what's shown here is the magnitude of the start frequency adjustment as a function of the baseline start frequency separation. So when the separation was small, they made large adjustments. When the separation was large, they didn't bother. The bats showed larger frequency adjustments when they were close together than when they were far apart. So what's shown here is the inner bat distance. It's a function of the start and showing start frequency separation. So when they were less than a half meter apart, that's when she saw the largest separations. And here are the flight configurations that she characterized. And the most common was this following flight in the males. This was not apparent in the females. And
are the bats able to use basically passive sonar? So they use the beam pattern off of one, the other bat to see.
That's an open question that we're now looking at, but I'm going to talk a little bit about that.
Just could you go back two slides? I didn't get the numbers for the separation bats. 18 kilohertz?
That's large.
Huge.
They can make a factor of two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is just taking measurements. So if we're talking about start frequency, we're talking about some adjustment here or adjustment there. Okay, so this just summarizes that the following flight was the most common configuration. And we saw with these male bats in particular, there was often, they were close together in this following flight configuration. And it was typically the trailing bat that was the successful bat in this competition. And as I'll, and I won't get into the details here, but that's what this slide shows. Was there a question?
No. It's like bicycle race. Drafting.
Could be, yeah. And this also seemed to be also related to the silent behavior, but I'll get to that in just. So the silent behavior was defined by one or both bats, but typically just one bat at a time, that ceased vocalizing for more than 200 milliseconds. So as Jim was describing how fast bats are processing information as they're flying, 200 milliseconds in bat time is actually quite a long time. The intervals between their calls are typically in the range of, in these tasks, 20, 50 milliseconds. So 200 milliseconds is a large time, and it was almost never observed in bats flying alone. But in the two-bat configuration, it appeared 40% of the time when bats were less than a meter apart. And just to give you a feel for the speeds of the bats are flying roughly 3 meters per second. And so assuming that the mean distance covered in this silent time was 1.5 meters with a range of 0.6 to 7.65 meters. So there were some bats that were flying long distances, loops in the room, without vocalizing. So we don't have to see that again. But here again, just like the frequency separations, the silent behavior also depended on the separation between the bats. So here we've got inner bat separation and the percentage silent behavior. So you see when they're close together, they're showing a lot more silent behavior than when they're far apart.
So I think maybe you had a slide on this earlier that you went through quickly. You showed that 40% to when the bats are less than a meter apart, but I imagine that probably also depends on their heading with respect to each other.
Well, most of, in these experiments, so this is everything put together, but their most common flight configuration was this following flight. Yeah.
How did they, the two bats there, share the silent intervals? Is it always the trailing bat that is silent?
Typically. Although that animation I showed is a little bit, it was a special trial because the bat was just right there behind. Sometimes it happened earlier back in the trial when maybe the one bat was in another part of the room when that silent bat ended up going in for the prey.
Can the first bat, the leading bat, be silent, whereas the one behind is vocalizing?
We don't typically see that, yeah.
And when they enter into this behavior, the trailing bat is pretty well able to just start falling no matter how curvy the first bat's head is.
Yeah, we haven't looked, typically they didn't show really rapid maneuvers in this task. And we haven't looked at that in detail, but we think that the trailing bat can just listen to. So the bats are familiar with the room. Earlier in the trial, they may have figured out where the prey item is and remembered that. The only thing they can't know is the position of the other bat without echolocating or listening passively to the sounds produced by that bat.
Mm-hmm. What, how much do the same type of call, say you're same distance from a target, two bats, same sex, same species, etc. What, how much do the calls differ in their spectrotemporal characteristics?
It really depends on the it depends on the individual. So some are very similar and some are very different.
Okay, so they do differ characteristically. So they could in fact know who
yes.
the bat is.
Yes.
Just to follow up on that, so the bat that's trailing, is that usually the one that's higher up in the social hierarchy?
Yeah, and I should say that trailing could be replaced with the word chasing, and sometimes there were some aggressive encounters. Get out of here, it's my, and we did another, we analyzed this data set and actually discovered some social calls that were produced in this competitive foraging situation. And it was only the male bats that produced this social call. that was a series of FM signals that were a little bit longer in duration, lower in frequency than the echolocation calls. And it was typically the bat that produced this social call, like, get out of my way, that's my food, that got the, that was actually successful with the prey capture.
So would you characterize this interaction always as competitive and never as cooperative?
I mean, there's only one prey item, for one. But in general, there's some evidence that bats that feed on fruit or blood actually do cooperate, but the insectivorous bats are every bat for him or herself. So Chen also looked at, did the discriminant function analysis to look at the silent behavior and how it related to how similar the bat calls were. And she looked at, used these call parameters and found that bat pairs with more similar call design showed more silent behavior. So here's a plot for showing this correctly classified by DFA. So if there's low classification, that means that they're more similar and there's more silent behavior than if the calls are very different. She also paired individual bats with more than one other bat. And that, so what's shown here are data from five different bats. This refers to the band number, hot pink 54 and so on. And so each bat was paired with one other bat with low similarity to their calls and high similarity. So black shows low similarity, white shows high similarity. And what she saw consistently across pairs is that when bats were paired with other bats whose calls were more similar to their own, showed more silent behavior. Okay. So this really raises the question of how much information the bats can acquire from the other animal. So this has come up. Can they get the information about the direction, the distance, object features? And the short answer is we don't know. The possibility, this silent behavior is not just a jamming avoidance response, but if the two bats' calls are similar, the brains of the two bats may be wired to better process the information from the conspecific, and so they may be better prepared to listen in and use this information. But when we're starting some experiments to look at that. But what we have seen is that these insectivorous bats always, always, always produce calls just before they prepare to intercept the insect, which suggests that they do need to make their own call to measure the precise location of that target to successfully intercept it. Earlier in the trial, we don't know how much information the bat could acquire from the other individual. But if they don't listen in, don't pay attention, this is what might happen.
Is that real
song?
No.
Is that
the real song? Not really.
You've got to show the specific now.
Right, right. The sound was added by my son who made the. Okay. So now I want to say a little bit about lingual echolocation. And this is the Egyptian fruit bat, Rosetta aegypticus. And this bat does this sort of teeth clenching as it makes echolocation sounds, or you may say it's smiling. So the mouth is completely open, and it produces tongue clicks. And here's a video to illustrate the tongue clicking behavior of this bat, which is quite distinct from the laryngeal echolocator. The bat you'll see in this raw video is flying to a landing platform, and this animation shows a reconstruction of the beam pattern of the click. So this is the bat, and this is the landing platform.
So the click, it has multiple frequencies then?
It's a broadband click.
What's the repetition rate?
So you'll see in this video that the bat produces pairs of clicks separated by about 20 milliseconds. So not enough time for a head movement to occur. And then the interval between click pairs depends on light level. These bats see very well. These experiments were done in complete darkness. But typically 50, 100 milliseconds between click pairs. So note that instead of directing the energy from the beam right at the platform, like what we saw in the big brown bat, this bat actually directs the maximum slope of the beam at the target, which we believe helps this animal with its localization of the
how does it make these two different directions without moving its head?
That is an extremely important, interesting question that we have been So we think it has to do with where the tongue is in the mouth. And actually, show you, we have a manuscript, or my postdoc has tried to model this using a phased array, but we really don't know. And it's difficult to know much about the tongue position without doing high-speed X-ray. And that is not trivial to, apart from just having the system to do this, to also keep the bat in its natural behavior when it's in this high-speed X-ray apparatus.
Is high-speed video of the face, you don't see what's happening.
No, we've tried. And just as a quick anecdote, when we tried to get the bat to echolocate with high-speed video right up face, we couldn't really get the bats to echolocate very much, and it seemed to be because there was some light in the room, so my graduate student turned off the light, and still the bats weren't echolocating. And then they realized, maybe the lights in the room outside the room where they were doing the testing was leaking in under the door. You know, this humans couldn't see this light, but they turned off the lights in the outer room, and then the bats started to echolocate. So this is what I mean about they have very high visual sensitivity.
Could you play that again?
Mm-hmm.
It looked like, at least at the end, the vocalizations are also phase-locked to the wing beam.
These are not vocalizations.
Okay.
These are tongue clicks.
Tongue clicks,
yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Watch at the end, you'll see. Just as his wings come forward, click, click, click.
Yeah. This has been observed in laryngeal echolocators. I hadn't ever paid attention to this particular video.
This may also have an effect on the directing of the sound,
yeah.
Right? If he's always vocalizing right here.
Yeah. I actually, in the target examinations, I had this raw video that I skipped over. It clearly showed in the laryngeal echolocator every time the bat's wings went up, there was a call.
It seems that there's a small change in the pitch when it does these pairs. Goes bump bump, but there seems to be a small change. That's just my imagination, or
to look at that. You know, we really see that these are broadband, very short clicks. There could be something there. These, of course, are been slowed down so we can hear them.
Right.
How the bat uses that information, we don't know.
But when you actually measure one of these, not when the bat is sitting still, but these remain broadband as they're then.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you had churned enough clicks, those teeth would make an array that would give you a specific frequency, a diffraction pattern that's controlled. You know, you get one on each side at a particular frequency, but with broadband, you shouldn't get that.
Yeah, we've done some really detailed measurements of the beam pattern. I can show you those later. Yeah. Thank everyone who participated in all this work. So Ben Falk, did the target discrimination experiments. and Koshi Ghosh built our microphone array and was involved in several of our studies looking at the bats' adaptive echolocation behavior. Anne-Marie Serlake was involved, again, in several experiments, including the obstacle avoidance and prey capture task. Chen Xu is one who first discovered this silent behavior. Michaela Warnicki has extended her studies and looking at some of the gender differences that I didn't have time to talk about. And Mel Wolgamuth and Ninad Kotari did the experiments with the bats on the platform, looking at changes in ear separation, head movements, and also their doing these neural recordings from the free-flying bats. And I want to thank Research Grants, and again, a hearty thanks to KITP and the organizers of this meeting. Questions?
I was wondering if you had an estimate for the bat's resolution at, say, 1 meter or 10 meters, both in the depth that they can resolve and also sort of, you know, lateral and vertical distances.
Yeah. So some years back, Jim Simmons did some psychophysical studies of range discrimination at different distances, and surprisingly, and he only went out to, I think, a meter and a half, the threshold did not change. I think this work needs to be repeated and further extended. And in azimuth and elevation, no one's done that.
But. And organisms like fish can, some of them echolocate underwater with a faster sound speed.
Well, not fish, but dolphins.
Dolphins.
Dolphins, and yeah. So toothed whales use echolocation. Yeah.
So fish can kick. It's not really.
I don't know if it's echolocation or. Yeah, I think it's probably more communication.
I was wondering about the harmonic content of these calls. Whether there is information there that the bat uses or even discards for when they reduce the amplitude going towards an object. The result of that might be that they can check this harmonics because they become louder and louder as the object gets closer. Is there any evidence of either way?
I think here it depends a lot on the species. So the horseshoe bat, the 83 kilohertz is actually the second harmonic. And the same is true of the mustache bat I didn't talk about today, but it uses also another constant frequency signal. The FM bats differ in the extent to which they use harmonics. So some have, you know, single harmonic signals, others have multiple stacks. No one has done experiments to really look directly at, you know, the possibility of throwing out information. Years ago, I did some filtering experiments where I had bats discriminate time delays, and when I filtered out the low frequency component of the fundamental, the lowest frequencies, the bats couldn't do the task. Jim Simmons has artificially, in some playback experiments, manipulated the timing of the harmonics and found that artificial manipulation of the timing of the harmonics throws off the bat quite a bit. We can talk more about it. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if anybody has looked with Daniel Kish, for example, when he equalocates in a room or in an environment with different objects of different complexity, say Mars versus humans. Has anybody looked what happens to these visual systems? So presumably V1 plays a very important role,
yeah.
Always. What about high order areas of the ventral stream? Are they
making that? Yeah, so there have been some fMRI studies of Daniel. Lutz Riekade in Munich has done these experiments. And I think also some human subjects who are not blind. And he's also done some simulations of environments with different reverberation and done fMRI studies while blind Daniel Kish and blindfolded other human, visually capable human subjects and looked and found activation in visual cortex, listening to sounds, and also some differences across subjects. So one of my colleagues actually at Johns Hopkins looks at cognitive processing in visually impaired individuals and looks at the and has found that, if I'm recalling correctly, I think it's V1, shows activation for language and mathematical processing in blind subjects.
In Braille,
yeah.
So
yeah. So the brain is a complex machine. Any other questions?